come to order. We have three items on work session before we resume our public hearing on the three insanity bills. I'd like to first take House Bill 2702. This bill was earlier reported by the full committee, then with an indicated minority report, then a further issue with respect to notice was raised by me vis-a-vis the staff. There was a request that amendments be prepared. It is a bill we need to act on, and if there's any minority report, get to the floor and get the decision made. So I would move that we reconsider the vote by which we earlier reported House Bill 2702.
No, we didn't.
Oh, excuse me. Yep, sorry, got the wrong one. Let's take 2158, started down that track. We need to reconsider the vote by which we earlier reported House Bill 2158. Is there any objection? Okay, reconsider.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just coming up with House 2158. I really don't have a better
That's something he can deal with the full committee.
Okay. Mr. Chair and committee members, what I've distributed is a revised version of House Bill 2158 that was adopted by the full committee on March 22nd. The changes in this legislative council version 2158-7 dated April 15th are found on page 2, lines 16 to 21, and lines 25 to 28. What those changes accomplish are
page 3 of the bill. Sorry.
That's where the changes are. I was going to point out that the point of these amendments are that the division, once it receives two major offenses that can contribute toward a habitual offender finding, is required to send a notice to the defendant. The question that came up that was raised in some conversations with Representative Scabera is that case law has found that absent that notice being provided to the individual after the second major offense, that there could not follow a finding of habitual offender after the third if that notice hadn't been provided. That the point of that notice is to let the person know that they are on their way toward habitual offender status, and that presumably the legislature intended, and the division does provide, an opportunity for the individual to meet with the department to try to talk about or be involved in improvement of their driving problem. So the changes in this bill, when we change it to an administrative procedure, it was restricted to a finding that was going to be made about whether the person was the person named and whether the convictions were those of the person. And there wasn't a reflection back on the question of whether the notice had been provided in this new administrative proceeding. It's somewhat unclear in the existing statutory language But when we switched over from the court findings to the administrative findings, it was very strictly limited to what the hearings officer from the division would be finding. So what these amendments do is to add the consideration of whether the division did provide the notice that's required under Section 4 of the Act. And then it says if it was not provided, then the division would dismiss the proceeding. That's the new language that is found on the amendments on page 2.
Right, and those amend the bill at page 4, starting at line 6. Have you had a chance to look at these amendments?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have any question about them or problem?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Vanita Howard from Motor Vehicles Division. No, the only thing we want to be sure of is that the word provided means that it was sent as provided by Section 4, that we're not getting into the business of saying, well, if the person didn't get it, unless... So if that means all we have to do is send it as we are provide as the language specifies in Section 4, then we have no problem.
Well, are you saying that you think it would be better to say sent than provided, or is the term provided, has that been interpreted in a way that would make that unnecessary?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure. I just think for the record we thought we should specify that when you do say provided, that it goes back to the by mailing of the notice or by personal service.
Mr. Chair, I was going to point out that the new subsection C says that subject to Section 5 of the 1983 Act, whether the division provided notice under Section 4 of the Act, and Section 5 states that a person's failure to receive notice does not prevent a finding that a person is a habitual offender in revocation if they refuse to sign or it couldn't be delivered because they didn't notify them of a change of address.
Thank you. Further questions of the amendments? Chair would move the adoption of the further amendments, LC 2158-7. Is there objection? Gator adopted. Further discussion of the bill as amended? Okay. I think it should be understood that if there is a minority report, we will resolve that by way of notification, and the opponents of any minority report can settle the text with the staff at the post-full committee level in accordance with our usual procedure. So there won't be any necessity at this time to give any notice of desire of anyone to be associated with the minority report. It is, however, important, I think, that we get the issue resolved because this bill does dovetail with the division's budget considerations and ways and means. Chair would move that House Bill 2158 as amended be reported to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. So further discussion? Call the roll. Oh, sorry.
Needs to be tabled.
It's tabled?
It's by tabled. Ruling? It's tabled by rule.
Chair moves the bill be taken from the table. House Bill 2158, is there objection? Chair moves House Bill 2158 as amended be reported to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Call the roll.
Hill?
Aye.
Walmart?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Springer?
No.
Meyer?
Aye. Great. Okay, now we'll take 2702.
Mr. Mr. Chair and committee members, at the last meeting on April 7th, is when the committee took this bill up. It requires that a person whose driver's license is suspended for failure to appear to pay a $10 reinstatement fee before the court would send a notice to the Department of Motor Vehicles for the license to be reinstated. It also provides that the monies collected from that reinstatement fee would be retained by the court to cover its costs. At the last meeting, the committee had asked, at the request of Representative Mason, that an amendment be prepared that also would require persons to pay for the cost of a copy of their driving record that the traffic court needs to order when the person is either found guilty or pleads guilty, and that those funds that would be recovered for court costs of obtaining the driving records would also be retained by the court for to cover its costs. And the amendment, LC amendment, House Bill 2702-1, dated April 29, 1983, was prepared to accomplish this.
Okay, it would be my intention to ask that the committee accompany a report on the bill with a recommendation that the measure be subsequently referred to Ways and Means so that it can be taken up down there in connection with the formulation of the biennial trial court budget, including the issue of whether any of the monies recovered should be retained within the system. I think that's particularly going to have to be a Ways and Means issue, obviously. And the chair would move the adoption of the proposed amendments, LC 2702-1, legislative council, to the bill. Is there objection? Okay, they're adopted. Is there further discussion of the bill as amended? Okay, I would move, the chair would move that House Bill 2702 as amended be referred to the full committee with a due pass recommendation and a recommendation that it be subsequently referred to the joint committee on Ways and Means. Further discussion? Call the roll.
Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Springer?
No.
Myers?
Aye.
Occurred to me after the earlier vote that we did not include a recommendation for subsequent referral on 2158. Does it bear a subsequent referral now? Do you recall?
No, thank you.
Okay, I would move that we amend our earlier recommendation on House Bill 2158, the full committee, to include a recommendation that it be subsequently referred to Ways and Means. Is there any objection to that amendment of our subcommittee action? That's approved. We have alternative amendments being finally completed by Legislative Council to 2369. They will be up in a little bit. Mr. Barton had also indicated he would not be able to return because of another shipment until about 2 o'clock. So I'm going to propose that we resume our hearing on the insanity bills, and we will take up 2369 when the amendments have arrived, have been distributed to the interested parties, and we have Mr. Barton back also. Okay. I want to again apologize to any of you who were inconvenienced by our having to interrupt the hearing on Wednesday on those on the insanity group of bills. We have tried very diligently in this committee not to do that, but we did have a caucus that we felt was simply imperative for the majority to attend, and it turned out that the minority similarly had important group of issues, one or more issues that our members here thought they had to be part of. So we simply had to break at the time I had not anticipated. Okay, let's see. Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Donald Turner. I'm a professor of law at the Lambeth University College of Law, teaching the areas of criminal law and criminal procedure evidence. member of the Oregon State Bar. I've had some contact criminal cases, occasionally involving an insanity defense. I'm appearing here today on behalf of the American Civil Liberties Union to indicate our opposition to the three bills before the committee, 2075, 2269, and 2892. While each of the bills have a slightly different approach, each shares a central feature found in section two of the two bills, and that is essentially abolition of the insanity defense. And we feel that these proposals to abolish the insanity defense implicate some grave civil liberties issues and raise some substantial constitutional questions. They will work a fundamental change in the theoretical underpinnings of our system of criminal justice. Today it's possible to say that somebody who lacks the capacity to control his conduct, appreciate the criminality of his conduct, is one upon whom we do not impose criminal liability if they are that way because of a mental disease or defect, that they are victims of the illness, which they didn't seek. And we do not punish people who were sick. These three bills would change that. They are intended to. They are wrong. The irreducible basis for criminal liability and deprivation of liberty in our Anglo-American legal system has been and should be an individual responsibility for acts and decisions. The elimination of the insanity defense would impose criminal responsibility on individuals who, due to their mental status, are not blameworthy. The concept of personal fault underlies the concept of criminality. The insanity defense has roots that are deep and wide. In one form or another, it goes back to the English system to about the 13th century. At one time or another, every state in the Union has had an insanity defense. And it is so closely interwoven of the fabric of the criminal law that it has become a part and parcel of our system of justice, a part of our scheme of order liberty, and seems inseparable from the protections of due process. There have been some few attempts to limit that. They have not been terribly successful in the courts. The U.S. Supreme Court hasn't confronted it yet. They have recognized some limitations upon the defense of the sort which permits you to impose a burden of proof on the person who asserts it. And on at least one occasion, they have declined an opportunity to declare that a particular definition of insanity was constitutionally based, or to define the concept of mens rea is based on the Eighth Amendment. However, it's noteworthy in the latter case, in Powell, that a majority of the court indicated their willingness to include strictures of choice and free will, consistent with the view that these concepts lay at the outer boundaries of criminality in the Eighth Amendment. Recent cases have suggested that some mens rea requirement may be constitutionally necessary. An article on the subject. For what value it may have, I remind you that the American Bar Association has twice come out in opposition to the idea of removing the insanity defense from the law in 1975 and again as recently as 3 months ago. The present statute you have here in Oregon and the system of control is represented by the PSRB are the result of careful and recent construction. And as the committee heard in Wednesday's testimony, they seem to be working rather well. Indeed, they are considered as a model to which others are looking. Under the circumstances, it seems that before abandoning a scheme so recently constructed, that we should carefully examine the criticisms. It's been suggested that when the defense is asserted in a contested criminal trial, anyway, there is a battle of experts, that somehow this demeans the system, that it confuses the jury, indeed that threatens the very credibility of the entire criminal justice system. The criticism smacks a bit of hyperbole. note, about 85% of the individuals committed to the PSRB arrive there as a result of stipulation of counsel. This suggests a certain amount of agreement. As for the remainder, I point out to you that our system of law chooses to resolve questions of fact in an adversary system. The method is confrontational. The testimony is likely to be conflicting. A battle of experts in this field should no more surprise us than a battle of witnesses on any other factual issue. In candor, I must note that my profession is not famous for its unanimity of opinion. Upon occasion, the Supreme Court has been known to fail to achieve unanimity, and I've even heard rumors that legislators are not always of the same mind. I suspect that the legal system can survive a measure of conflict among experts who testify. A second criticism is related to the first. It suggested that the level of disagreement among those in the mental health field renders the defense scientifically unsound and results in a large number of inappropriate commitments. The suggestion is disposed of by reference to the statistics noted in the committee's hearing Wednesday. The level of agreement among primary diagnosis of psychiatrists and psychologists who examine the patient is reassuringly high. The area of disagreement is substantially limited to diagnosis of personality disorder. I think we may feel comfortable with an 85% agreement rate. I'm not sure that you would have that rate of agreement with the result of most criminal jury trials. There seems little point in pursuing the New York statistics. A third criticism arises due to the rise in total acquittals during the latter part of the 70s. That's possible to interpret more than one way. On one hand, I suppose it may mean that too many are being acquitted. It may also mean, however, that up until that point, too many defendants who weren't responsible for their actions were being convicted. It may also be a statistical anomaly. In any event, it appears that the number is leveling off and indeed declining. A fourth criticism can be leveled at the high number of stipulated results. If such criticism reflects dissatisfaction with the plea negotiation process, I remind the committee that trial avoidance by plea negotiation and stipulation is prevalent throughout the criminal justice system. It's certainly not limited to the insanity defense. An abolition of that defense is unlikely to solve that particular problem. A fifth criticism is advanced relating to the problem of recidivism and the prospect of premature release. There is indeed a public perception that a successful NGI defense will result in the early release of dangerous individuals. The accuracy of the perception is subject to question. Certainly the statistics given to you last Wednesday do not indicate that. And as this committee is going to be all too well aware, the same criticism from time to time has been directed at the correction system as well. At the very least, comparison of the two should await comparative statistics with common definitions involving both systems. I'd suggest that those criticisms would not warrant rushing to abandon a system that seems to be working well. Next, I want to move to the question of evidentiary effects of the proposals. All three bills declare that, except as it may relate to the defendant's culpable mental state, the issue of whether a defendant at the time of engaging in criminal conduct suffered from a mental disease or defect is not material to the determination of the defendant's guilt or innocence. Permit me one academic nit to pick. It has no civil liberties impact whatsoever. But I would really have preferred that the draftsman not use the word material, since the evidentiary distinction between material and relevant evidence was supposedly eliminated by the last legislature when they adopted the Oregon Evidence Code. Now, you may recall the legislative commentary approvingly noted that the rule has the advantage of avoiding the loosely used and ambiguous word material. Having praised your wisdom so lavishly then, I'd prefer not to return to the classroom and blush. However, let me also point out some more serious consequences that you may not appreciate. If you limit evidence of such a condition to only one element of the crime, the criminal definition, you should realize that you are excluding its admission in a variety of other contexts. As Mr. Swain reminded us Wednesday, guilt involves more than simply conduct and culpable mental state. One may avoid guilt by successfully asserting a number of defenses and affirmative defenses and mitigating circumstances. The effect of the language in the bill appears to be that such evidence is inadmissible, even though directed at self-defense, defense of others, defense of premises, defense of property, choice of evils, entrapment, coercion, whatever. I wonder if you thought through the consequences of that choice. There are also a number of particular offenses where the defendant's guilt depends upon the reasonableness of some belief. For instance, assume with me for a minute that two retarded individuals are involved in an apparently consensual sexual act. At a criminal trial, evidence of the victim's mental state can be introduced to show that the consent was invalid because she lacked capacity. Your bill, on the other hand, would, after leaving the prosecution free to introduce that evidence, prohibit the defendant from showing an identical handicap for the jury to consider in determining whether his belief in her consent was appropriate. I remind you also that many assaultive offenses assume an unconsenting touching battery of some sort, although that is not a part of the definition of culpable mental state. I want to draw your attention also to extreme emotional disturbance, a fact which may mitigate an intentional killing from murder to manslaughter. Extreme emotional disturbance is not a culpable mental state by statutory definition. ORS 161.085 lists what culpable mental states are. This isn't listed. I assume you don't want to exclude expert testimony of this nature on that subject. Since the statute specifically refers to first-degree manslaughter as one of the specially designated offenses, it would be prudent, however, to make that fact clear. Now, let me turn to some culpable mental states which form a part of the criminal definition. Each bail authorizes admission of evidence of mental defect or disease when it's offered to disprove a culpable mental state. Two of the bills provide for a verdict of not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect if the defendant is thereby unable to form the required mental state. That is, of course, not the recognition of an insanity defense. The concepts of insanity and mens rea are distinct. If a defendant does not possess the required culpable mental state, he simply hasn't committed the crime, by definition, whether it's the result of a mental problem or ignorance or whatever it may be. He simply doesn't fit the definition of that crime. Two of the bills, 2269 and 2892, go much further than merely abolishing the insanity defense. They would prohibit the defense from introducing evidence of mental disease or defect, even on the issue of mens rea, even on the issue of culpable mental state, unless the evidence totally and completely, in one case, and completely in the other case, eliminates the capacity to form and possess that required mental state. By imposing a bar to otherwise relevant evidence, unless it meets such a standard, these bills deprive the defendant of his right to present evidence upon an essential element of the crime. One's hard-pressed to think of any other example of such a drastic rule. There is certainly a slight partiality in rules which permit the prosecution to introduce evidence that has any tendency to make a fact of consequence to the determination of the action more probable or less probable than it would be without the evidence, while holding the defendant to this standard. While states are relatively free to devise and apply their own rules of evidence, there are at least some constitutional limitations upon the degree to which an evidentiary device can be used to preclude the criminal defendant from presenting relevant evidence of innocence. and there is a site mandate. The difficulty an expert would have in testifying was illustrated by Dr. Bloom's testimony before you Wednesday, when he indicated he felt the person would have to be unconscious. I am at a loss to imagine what the effect is on lay opinion evidence of insanity. Now, let me move to some procedural incidents of the proposed bill. 2075, the interim committee bill, provides that after conviction, either prosecutor or defendant, either, may seek a disposition hearing based upon an allegation that the defendant lacked capacity. The court may consider evidence presented at trial or hearing, and if persuaded of the fact, shall sentence the defendant to the maximum. There are similar provisions in 2269, except that the maximum sentence is not per se required. Both bills then contain a designation of offenses, prohibit conditional release or leave of absence, and direct the defendant's transfer to the corrections division to serve the remainder of the sentence upon discharge. It's unnecessary to dwell upon the therapeutic event.
Some of the real dangerous crimes, but a lot of them are there on UUV and thefts and burglaries. And although burglary is certainly a crime that would have an impact in the community, but as far as being personally dangerous, there are a lot of commitments on these lesser crimes. I cannot justify a full-blown psychiatric trial on a UUV case when I have, particularly in Marion County, in our present state of affairs, that is a real problem. I'm sure that enters into stipulations throughout the state. I will tell you that in our county, however, I can only think of a couple of stipulations in the past couple of years, because we have tried consciously to cut back on those stipulations, because the more work we do in the area, the more loopholes and the more we realize that the defense is an invitation or abuse. And if you dig hard enough, and if you're able to spend enough time and enough resources in the important cases, you can see that it's inappropriate. That was what the Moore case was all about. People, and you've heard testimony before you, the Museum Tavern shooting out here in Salem 2 years ago. You've heard testimony, well, obviously this man was mentally ill, and therefore, the proper verdict, or the truth in this case, was that he should have been committed to the state hospital. I don't agree with that at all. Mental illness of itself does not mean that guilt should be excused. And I hope that everyone realizes that. People gloss over that from time to time, and I guess it's a pet peeve that I have. Mental illness merely means that you get to the point where you start investigating whether the defense should be proposed. There are other tests that must be complied with, and just because someone is mentally ill doesn't mean that they're going to commit a crime. I think you've heard Dr. Bloom testify that probably 85% of schizophrenics do not commit crimes at all. Mental illness and schizophrenia does not mean that you will commit crimes. Probably the statistics will show that, or I can say, not say probably, but the statistics will show that the rate of criminal activity among mentally ill population is approximately the same as the rate of criminal activity among the so-called normal population. And so you look to other tests to decide whether or not this person was really acting under the influence of mental illness, and that was the cause of this crime, or whether or not there was another reason for the crime. Person may be mentally ill and be driving down the road and see a red light and decide, hey, I'm late to my appointment, or I'm going to the Blazer game and I don't want to miss the tip-off, and I'm going to run that red light. That doesn't mean that he should be excused for running that red light. It means that he's a mentally ill person that decided to break the law. And because of that, he should be punished. Now, if, on the other hand, this person's driving down the road and he sees the red light, he says, that red light is a red eye of a dragon who is going to kill me unless I can escape. Now, if that's the reason for running the red light, well, under the tests proposed by the Department of Justice, all of these tests, he did not have the criminal intent to break that statute, to break the law. And in that situation, he should be excused and treated differently. But the problem is drawing the line. And that is what the committee has been asked to do, to draw the line. Because the way it is structured now, there is no line, and there's no parameter, and there need to be some parameters. And that's what we're asking you to do.
Representative Courtney.
You successfully prosecuted the Moore case and fought off an insanity plea defense. Was his mental illness, was the man mentally ill?
Yes, and we conceded that he was mentally ill.
Are you saying that his mental illness...
His mental illness was not the reason for the crime. And we attacked...
So even if we had, in the law now, Dale, a guilty verdict, even in the mental illness area, as opposed to now not responsible, or whatever you want to call it, and he had been found guilty, but then somehow or other in the process, if we had a system that said, but you're mentally ill, or they don't say but, or ended, you are assigned to Oregon, you're sentenced to Oregon State Hospital for 100 million years, you would say that is not what should have been done with Larry Moore.
Well, I'm saying that, and that you've heard the testimony at the interim committee, and I think really the decision that I heard coming out of the interim committee and that I thought that everyone was trying to accomplish is that the committee realized that the mental disease defense without any parameters is a sham, and it allows anything and everything to be presumed, even though it's inappropriate. It frustrates the search for the truth rather than facilitates the search, these restrictions on examinations on all of this. And it should not be in the guilt or innocence phase of the trial, the historical fact phase of the trial. And if you have a defendant who commits a crime, but then exhibits some problems of mental illness, then perhaps the appropriate position for treatment would be at the dispositional phase. Just as if a person who's an alcoholic stands before the judge and says, the reason I did this crime was alcohol. Well, unless he can demonstrate some mental illness really from that alcohol, unless he can demonstrate brain damage because of his alcoholic nature, it is not a defense under the present law. Therefore, it comes in later at sentencing as a mitigating factor or something that perhaps the judge should consider for treatment. And that is really what 2075 was about, I think, was to try to get this confusing mechanism of the defense, which frustrates the search for the truth, out of the guilt or innocence phase and into the disposition phase. Maybe that's something that should be treated and should be looked at. But let's make sure that this person doesn't walk out of the door either. And let's make sure that if it's something that could be treated, alcoholism can go from the severe alcoholic to the social drinker that's on the verge of alcoholism. Mental illness is the same way. You might have a severely mentally ill person, and you might have the person who has some adjustment problems, but he knows what he's doing, and he makes a conscious decision to break the law. Under those facts, he should not just be given over to the PSRB, who has to make some hard decisions now. This man is no longer dangerous, or is he really mentally ill? We have to discharge him, or perhaps we should put him on conditional release and watch after him. Perhaps he needs to be punished, but also treated for the illness.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you very much for your statement. Nelda Grover.
Before speaking, I would like to say that on Wednesday we had four speakers. I'm Nelda Grover, the chairman of the Legislative Committee for TMED of Portland. We had four speakers on Wednesday, and I'm the only one that's here, and you have the testimony of Mary Kadrasia, J. Jean Stanford and Barbara Reinertsen in addition to mine. Mr. Chairman and committee members, TMED is an organization for family and friends of the chronically mentally ill in the greater Portland area. We are affiliated with the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, NAMI. TMED has voted to accept the NAMI position adopted at their convention August 5th, 1982 in Arlington, Virginia. This position is that we support the plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. This defense expresses the well-established principle that one who lost his or her reason may not be criminally condemned or held criminally for what he or she has done. We are inalterably opposed to the guilty but mentally ill plea. TMED believes that reasonable procedures have been developed in Oregon through the Psychiatric Security Review Board, which permit conditional release for mentally ill individuals who have committed serious crimes. The conditional release provides supervised monitoring by qualified members of the medical, legal, and social work professions in order to ensure that the safety of the public and individual are safeguarded. One layperson is also a member of the PSRB. Oregon is the only one of the 50 states to provide this service. TMED supports the Psychiatric Security Review Board as it presently performs. One of the major problems underlying the insanity defense is the public's lack of knowledge about mental illness, our number one health problem. According to the National Mental Health Association, approximately 30 million Americans, one in seven, suffer some form of mental or emotional illness. Mentally ill individuals have long been discriminated against, victimized, and burdened by our society, which assigns to them the role of dangerous and unpredictable behavior. 98% of chronically mentally ill persons do not commit acts of violence. As a result of their illness, most are passive, withdrawn, frightened, and anxious about attempting even many of the activities of ordinary living. And I would like to add, such as driving a car. My son has known since he was 16 years old, he's now nearly 39, that he could not drive a car. He suffered a confusion. He understood. He had enough intelligence to know. He's a very gifted boy before he became ill, that he couldn't drive. In a rare public comment on April 9, 1983, U.S. District Judge Barrington Parker, who presided at the trial of John W. Hinckley Jr., said the insanity defense should be retained. He said the Hinckley verdict should not serve as an opportunity for a launching pad to abolish the insanity defense. Judge Parker cautioned against finding a simplistic approach to a complicated problem. To imprison a mentally ill person for a criminal act, which is the result and the product of their mental illness, is a clear retreat to the Middle Ages. Judge Parker said the insanity defense is vital to a healthy society. Eliminating the insanity defense would remove from the criminal law and public conscience the vitally important distinction between illness and evil, or would tuck it away in an administrative process. TMED thinks House Bills 2269 and 2075, which both abolish the insanity defense, are designed to punish criminals abusing the insanity defense. But in reality, they end up punishing the chronically mentally ill twice, once for the crime and once for being mentally ill. Although House Bill 2892 does not send the chronically mentally ill to prison after being treated in the mental hospital till they're in remission, it does away with the insanity plea by making the criteria for using it so stringent that no one can use it. Since other states admire Oregon's PSRB and its performance and may use it as a model, we see no reason for the three bills on the insanity defense. Although not perfect, our system works well.
Thank you. Are there questions, Ms. Turner? Thank you very much for returning. Again, sorry about the inconvenience on
all
Wednesday.
Right, thank you.
And for bringing the other statements, which we will review and make part of our record, if you would inform your those that you've been working with. Leonard Robert.
I'm Nina Robart. I'm the private attorney for the practice of law in Hillsboro, Oregon. I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar Committee on Detentions and Correction, and I've brought with me today from that committee our committee position statement on all legislation designed to alter or change the insanity defense and PSRB system we have now, specifically what you have before you, House Bill 2269, 2075, and 2892. We are opposed to those three bills and any other legislation that would substantially alter the system as it exists now. I'm also appearing on my own behalf. I spent about 3 years in Multnomah County District Attorney's Office prosecuting cases. I've been in the defense bar now for about 3 years, and I've, during the last 3 years, have represented about 58 persons who either are currently or have been in Oregon State Hospital under the jurisdiction of the board when they were trying to get out. I'm not going to read the position statement to you, but I'd just like to review briefly the reasons or the aspects of the system that we think are important. There are some changes that this committee would not have any objection to. For instance, the label, whether you call it guilty, not responsible. We recognize the logic of the OCDAA position of guilty not being logically appropriate. However, we simply don't care how one arrives at the or the name of the defense or the name of the result, as long as the basic underlying system is not changed. We feel it is important that all persons who are seriously mentally ill to a point that it seriously affects their culpability should be under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board if they have committed an act which would constitute a crime but for their mental illness. For many of the reasons that have been discussed before you, basically the long-term commitment or the long-term, can't think of the word, supervision that the board has over these people. The authority to retain jurisdiction for the entire length of time that the statute permits as incarceration for the crime, we think is equally important for the same reason. The authority to place the persons on conditional release if they feel it's appropriate under the statutory guidelines that exist now. And the authority to reinstitutionalize a person on conditional release if that person violates the terms of his conditional release. The main reasons that this committee believes that you should retain the system are the conditional release provisions and also to prevent these people from going into the already overloaded corrections system. There are two of your bills. I believe they are 2269 and 2892. That would probably eliminate the defense. You've already heard that. The 2075, which you've heard discussed many times, would permit people who were found not guilty, even though they were seriously mentally ill and dangerous, to simply walk right back out into the community. It was suggested before you, and I don't remember who suggested this, but it was suggested to you that those persons ought not to be in the criminal justice system at all. If they're that seriously mentally ill, somebody else ought to take care of them. The problem is, who's going to do it? There was a suggestion that the civil side might do it, but I submit to you the civil side is not going to do that. For one thing, many of these people who are very seriously mentally ill are schizophrenic. that's a disease that's controllable by medication and is controlled once they come to the attention of the authorities. Once they get to trial, they have already been controlled by the medication under, you know, it takes several months to get to that point. By the time they've finished with their trial or even their plea or whatever they did, they would be no longer at that time dangerous under the civil criteria, which is different. That's one of the beauties of the program we have now, is that the reason the PSRB has jurisdiction for so long a period of time is because if the person has a mental disease which is in remission, and if that could become active within a reasonable medical probability, and when active the person would be dangerous, the board can retain jurisdiction. That's not the case under the civil commitment statute. The person has to be dangerous to himself or others at the time he's sitting there before the civil commitment board. I really urge you to read, if you haven't already done so, the statistics that have come from the Psychiatric Security Review Board cases. Many of those statistics are contradictory to what the Attorney General and the OCDAA papers put out. When we made our decision on this case, by the way, it was unanimous, and our board is made up, or our committee is made up of approximately an equal number of prosecutors throughout the state, defense attorneys. There's a member of the Oregon Association of Counties, Association of Oregon Counties. There's a county council. There's a juvenile defense attorney. The committee was unanimous in this position. There was not a solitary person, including the district attorneys on that committee, who had any objection to any of the aspects that are in that position statement. We had at our disposal James Sanderson's writings that you have. We had before us some of what you have of Jess Rogers and Dr. Bloom. We had before us the Attorney General's material that you have. We had a good part of what you have in as you deliberate. And we unanimously came to this conclusion that the system is working now and it ought to be left alone. What are you going to do with these people? Basically, apparently the thrust is to have fewer people in the system that currently operates with the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Somebody wants fewer not responsible pleas or insane pleas or whatever. I still haven't heard any good reason why, with 85 per year and what, 3% to 5% going to trial, the rest stipulated, why there's such a push to have fewer of them. I just frankly don't know. But what are you going to do with the people that are currently going into that system, even though they are few in number relative to the entire defense population? What are you going to do with them? From what I can understand of the correction system, you have before you, and the Senate has before the Senate, a number of bills regarding their problems with money. Every system in this state has problems with money. The corrections department, I think the beds for their sex abuse program, which is an excellent program for providing for that particular mental problem, has a waiting list of several months in the pen before a person can get a bed to get into that system. In fact, unless a person is sentenced to at least 2 years minimum, they can't even get into that system. Well, what are you going to do with these people? I can't answer that, and you have more bills and more issues before you that relate to that subject than I am even aware of. But I ask you to consider that in view of all the other people that you have to please or do something with in this legislative session. One other point I'd like to address, particularly on behalf of myself, and that is the appropriateness of the people that are in the Oregon State Hospital under the jurisdiction of the board. I've heard some of the comments of the district attorney, Deputy District Attorney Penn, and he and I simply have a different view, I guess, of mental illness entirely. But the people that I go down to talk to, when I go down to interview these people for the purposes of seeing if they have any kind of a legal argument that can get them out, and that's what my job is in that capacity, are almost without exception extremely mentally ill. They know who I am. They know what I'm there for. They know that I'm there to get them out if it's possible. And they want out. There are a few exceptions. I go down now and again, and a guy will tell me, no, he knows he's sick, he wants to stay there, he doesn't want out. This is a truly institutionalized person, but most of them want out. And yet, almost without exception, they exhibit to me the behavior that the doctors claim are looking at when they say they are schizophrenic or they are manic depressive or whatever it is they are. I ask them if they're mentally ill. No. But they'll sit there and go through the one guy sits on the table and claims to me, for instance, now I know that a lot of people hear voices. And I know most of those people are sick. But the voices I hear are real. They're real. These are real people talking to me. And he goes on for 45 minutes. This is a man who is trying to convince me that he ought to get out of the hospital. My point is, most of my clients are like this. And my point is, if these people fool the system, were not mentally ill to a serious degree, and they got down there by fooling the courts, by fooling whoever, the doctors, they would be able to turn it around at the point that I get down there to talk to them in order to prove that they were not dangerous, they were not mentally ill, and they could get out. They cannot. These people are not there inappropriately. And these people, most of them, are dangerous at the time when they are not extremely well supervised and medicated. And those persons within the correction system, someplace else, now present a problem, the people that don't enter the plea of not responsible. And you're simply going to exacerbate that problem if you try to keep them from going into the system.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. I think you were one of the persons who had to return the second time. I appreciate you taking the time to do that. Thank you. Okay, we'll take about a 5-minute recess at this point before we pick up our discussions of the issues before us.
Margie just, she's out of town.
She's out of town. She left at 11.
First of all, let's see, we haven't got enough numbers for that. And 2269 are on the table by operation of rules, so I'm going to move that we take from the table 2075 and 2269 so that they can be officially before us throughout our discussions. Is there any objection to untabling the two bills? Okay, they're untabled. What I'd like to do before we leave the issue of insanity defense today, and as the prelude to coming to grips with the decision-making that's before the subcommittee, I'd like to spend a few minutes working out an agreed list of the issues that are presented to the subcommittee by the proposals before us and the testimony that we've heard. And I wonder if I could ask Felicia, I wonder if you and Dale and Jeff could join us at the table as we work through that exercise so that we can readily discuss it with you as we go through that.
Jeff is downstairs.
Just
looking for some ice.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, may I, Bob Maddox, just tell you for the record, submit this testimony and distribute it that was left by other people on this panel?
Sure.
We have testimony by Jim Russell at the governor's office on House Bill 2892. Testimony on all three bills relating to the insanity defense from the mental health division.
dated April 26, 1983, from Doctors 11, and testimony dated April 28th on the three bills from the Ecumenical Ministries Board.
The bills will be distributed to the subcommittee members and made part of the hearing record. Jeff, could you join us up here? What I'd like to do at this time is to try to work through an agreed list of the issues that are before the subcommittee as presented by the proposals viewed as a whole and the testimony that we've heard. Use that as the stepping stone to decision by the subcommittee over the course of one or perhaps two more work sessions. First of all, I suppose that a threshold issue is the question of whether we want to redefine mental disease or defect, redefinition of mental disease or defect. Does that strike you as a rather threshold question?
I might advise the committee that really this is not a definition of mental disease or defect in these bills. It's a test for the defense. And I think when you talk about defining out personality disorders, then you're starting to talk about a definition of mental illness or mental disease or defect under the statute. But,
all right, let's call it restatement of test of mental disease or defect.
If I might elaborate a little on that, I agree. I think there are two aspects to that, and they can be considered separately.
All right.
One is the part of the test which the phrase mental disease or defect itself. The other is the resulting lack of capacities. And I agree with Mr. Penn, those things are separate. You can be mentally ill, but still not meet the other parts of the test. So I think in deciding whether to redefine the test for the insanity plea, it might be helpful to think in terms of two aspects: mental disease or defect aspects. Secondly, the resulting lack of capacity either to appreciate or to conform.
And I think we've all agreed that the personality disorders is the issue that's most troublesome to everybody.
Now that goes to the first of these two aspects, as I understand. Is that correct?
Yes. I see them as sequential.
Right.
You've got to have a mental disease or defect first to pass that point. If you get past that, then you can go on to whether as a result of that you lack those capacities.